ESG standards. In 2005, the United Nations brought together a group of 20 influential investors from 12 different countries, as well as 70 experts from the investment industry, to develop the Principles for Responsible Investment. Now, according to PRI, the six Principles for Responsible Investment are a voluntary and aspirational set of investment principles that offer a menu of possible actions for incorporating ESG issues into investment practice. The principles were developed by investors for investors. In implementing them, signatories contribute to the developing of a more sustainable global finance system. When PRI officially launched in 2006, there was a total of 100 signatories. Today, there are more than 3,000, and together they control more than $100 trillion in assets. Yes, you read that correctly, $100 trillion. Although PRI is officially independent, it continues to work very closely with the United Nations and other Great Reset allies. And even though it is a purely voluntary association, it openly acknowledges that it fully expects governments to demand in the near future many of the so-called sustainable principles that it supports. Even more important, PRI investors are convinced that governments and central banks will soon start shoveling even more cash into the coffers of those businesses that agree to sign on to the Great Reset agenda. You don't need to be a genius to see that the Principles for Responsible Investment Group is more concerned with finding ways to profit off of cronyism and government mandates than fighting climate change or battling income inequality. In a section of PRI's website titled, "What is the Inevitable Policy Response?" PRI states that it is inevitable that governments will be forced to act more decisively than they have so far on the issue of climate change. Quote, "The question for investors now is not if governments will act," PRI claims, "but when they will do so, what policies they will use, and where the impact will be most felt." The IPR, Inevitable Policy Response Project, forecasts a response by 2025 that, quote, will be forceful, abrupt, and disorderly because of the delay, end quote, 352. PRI then goes on to encourage its investors to focus on putting money into companies, projects, and other investments that are closely aligned with green energy. Why? It's because PRI is full of people desperate to win the love and affection of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. No, it's not that. It's because green energy projects are where the government-printed modern monetary theory money will go under Joe Biden and many other government administrations around the world over the next several years. The Big Three. Now, it's tempting to think that government is the primary driver of corporations' move towards ESG and other woke causes, and it has undoubtedly played a significant role. However, perhaps the biggest reason so many corporations have agreed to adopt Great Reset principles in recent years is because of the voting power and influence of large Wall Street investment management companies, not the authority of government agencies. In the previous section, I explained investors are promoting ESG in part because they believe government regulations and spending programs are moving in that direction, and they don't want to be left behind when the Great Reset is fully in place. Corporations looking to attract new investors and raise their stock prices are reworking their business models to please these investors. But that is only part of the story. In many cases, corporations are effectively being forced to change by powerful investment groups. Now, how can an investment management firm coerce a giant company to enact radical new corporate policies, including ESG scoring systems? Well, by owning so much stock that they can alter corporate policies through shareholder resolutions, or even replace corporate board members who refuse to go along with the Great Reset. The consolidation of stock ownership in the hands of a small group of investment management companies is a relatively new and exceedingly dangerous development. The three largest stock index fund managers, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street Global Advisors, have quadrupled their average combined stake in S&P 500 companies over the past two decades. According to research by Lucian Bebchuk, a professor at Harvard Law School, and Scott Hurst, an associate professor at Boston University School of Law, the average ownership stake of the big three investment firms was 5.2% in 1998. By 2017, it was 20.5%. Even more important, the big three collectively cast an average of about 25% of the votes at S&P 500 companies. That means when the three big firms demand that corporate America jumps, most CEOs can respond with only, how high? This consolidation of voting power is likely to get worse in the coming years. Bebchuk and Hurst believe that, quote, the big three could well cast as much as 40% of the votes in the S&P 500 companies within another two decades. If that were to occur, three Wall Street firms working in conjunction with a relatively small group of other shareholders could effectively control nearly all of corporate America. Although the influence of the big three has yet to reach the 40% mark, many corporations today are effectively controlled by a combination of the 10 investment groups and financial institutions with the most assets under management. Collectively, the total assets controlled by the big 10 investment groups, a list that includes Goliaths like JP Morgan Chase, Fidelity, and Goldman Sachs, are worth more than $34 trillion. Again, let me put that number into perspective. America spent $12.5 trillion on goods and services in 2020. The total U.S. GDP in 2020 was less than $21 trillion. Remember, they have the investment power of $34 trillion. Many of the largest asset managers are deeply involved in the ESG movement, and some have openly supported the Great Reset. For example, Lawrence Fink, the CEO of BlackRock. He's on the board of directors of the World Economic Forum. He is a vocal proponent of the reset. State Street's global advisor, the folks who installed the Fearless Girl statue from across Wall Street's bull statue as a publicity stunt in 2017, they launched a widespread campaign in 2017 to force companies to have more women on their board of directors. The move was part of the company's strong commitment to ESG standards. In 2018, the publication Institutional Investor reported State Street expanded the policy and said it will vote against the entire slate of board members on the nominating committee of any company not meeting its gender diversity criteria. According to the Institutional Investor, as of 2018, State Street says that more than 300 companies have added a female board of director in response to its demands, and that another 28 have pledged to do so. Additionally, it is important to note that every one of the top largest asset managers have signed the Principles for Responsible Investment. As is often the case, if you still want to truly understand why big corporations or large government agencies act the way they do, follow the money. Shifting standards. Now, even if you happen to believe that banks and investment management groups should be shoving other businesses towards green energy and other environmental causes, it's important to remember the fluid nature of ESG standards. As I discussed earlier, many of the metrics in ESG systems revolve around environmental causes, but this doesn't mean that's where it ends. ESG elites have begun to add metrics that punish businesses who work with some weapons manufacturers. How long before firearm manufacturers and sellers lose access to business loans or other services because banks are worried about their precious ESG score falling by a point or two? How long before fast food giants and soda manufacturers are deemed just too dangerous for the public health? Once the full ESG system imagined by great resetters is firmly in place, no business or industry will be able to survive the ire of the ruling class elites who run it. Even individual politicians could be targeted. In 2021, Americans witnessed some of the earliest attempts by the banks to use their power to punish specific political figures in the United States. According to a report by Bloomberg.com, officials at Deutsche Bank and New York-based Signature Bank said in January 2021 they will no longer do business with Donald Trump, despite both banks' long-standing relationships with the Trump family and its businesses. According to the banks, the decision was based on political matters, not financial concerns, end quote. Even more stunning, Bloomberg.com further reported Signature Bank announced it will not do business in the future with any members of Congress who voted to disregard the Electoral College, referring to members of the U.S. House and Senate who questioned the validity of the 2020 presidential races in several states after evidence emerged pointing to the possibility of voter fraud. Other industries and large corporations have also engaged now in the targeting of individuals. Shortly after the January 6, 2021 riots at the U.S. Capitol, book publisher Simon & Schuster announced the cancellation of Senator Josh Hawley's book, The Tyranny of Big Tech. In Simon & Schuster's announcement, they vaguely alluded to Hawley's demands for investigations into potential voter fraud occurring during the 2020 presidential election as the primary reason for the cancellation. Simon & Schuster also suggested that by demanding election investigations, Hawley had helped to encourage the riots, a ludicrous assertion. Even more troubling, courts will likely do very little to stop ESG's infringement of individual liberties because ESG standards don't necessarily need to be controlled by the government directly. So whenever international elites want to manipulate society, silence political opponents, or engage in otherwise horrifying, tyrannical behavior, all they have to do is, under the ESG system, add another metric or two to the global ESG framework, and they could effectively nullify free speech, an issue I discuss more extensively later on. The right to keep and bear arms, or the number of constitutionally protected rights, and all of this could be accomplished without the consent of the American people. Your very own ESG score. Some might be tempted to think, yeah, well, I'm not a politician, I'm not a gun rights group or an oil company, I don't have anything to worry about. This is a massive mistake. If banks and other financial institutions can target well-funded special interest groups, President Donald Trump, and sitting members of Congress, some of the most powerful and influential people in the world, what makes you believe that they would think twice about debanking or silencing or punishing you, regardless of your political views, if you belong to a political group or club or organization, association, a religion, or business considered to be standing in the way of the elite goals? The framework for providing ESG scores to Main Street Americans, not just big companies, has already been built. You might have an investment account for your 401k or savings or whatever, but I want you to look at it, because most likely you have received an ESG score without you even knowing it. In March 2021, a friend of mine who works for a small think tank and well acquainted with the Great Reset, let's call him Chris, yeah, that's his name, reached out to my staff after he discovered that his account with Merrill Lynch, one of the world's largest investment services companies and subsidiary of Bank of America, had been given an ESG score. The score had been formulated by examining the ESG scores of the various companies Chris had invested in. Now, Chris is just a regular guy with a 401k retirement account. He's young. He doesn't have an investment portfolio that's overflowing with cash. He's just a regular, hardworking guy, probably very similar to a lot of people reading this book right now. He never asked for his investments to be given an ESG score. And when he found it, he wasn't happy, to say the least. To find out his ESG score was an abysmal 4.7 out of 10. What a degenerate. But Merrill Lynch gave him an ESG score anyway, because they're just such nice people over there, and they always offer guidance on how Chris should, you know, how Chris could improve his accounts, you know, and his ESG score in the future. And, you know, heck, I'm sure they're going to stop by Chris's house and help him with his golf game, too. Are you getting nervous yet? Because you should be. In full disclosure, my research team has been contacted by a very large financial institution that wasn't happy with the warnings about ESG scores that I have issued on my radio and television shows. The bank, which I'll not name here because the conversation was off the record, controls hundreds of billions of dollars in assets. Now, the financial institution's main complaint was not that my reporting on ESG scores has been factually inaccurate, but rather that my fears about ESG scores are overblown. In conversations with my staff, bank officials insisted that they were not forcing individual investors to do anything based on an account's ESG score. And that is true for now. But the most terrifying part of the Great Reset's ESG system is not what they're doing today, although there's plenty of there to worry about, to be sure. It's what could be done with these ESG scores and other similar metrics in the future. The framework to manipulate and control the economy is being built right now. Much of it has been in place for years, and we didn't even know it. A huge number of the world's largest, wealthiest corporations have already bought into the ESG system. They have employees who spend most of their days conducting international audits related specifically to ESG scoring. CEOs from all over the world are regularly working with groups like the World Economic Forum to expand and refine the ESG scores. The SEC, as we've already shown, is now getting involved with ESG reporting and beginning the process of issuing ESG-related regulations. S&P Global, the organization that produces the S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average stock indexes, now even has an S&P 500 ESG stock index. Investment companies like Merrill Lynch have started providing the individual investors, even people with relative small accounts, with ESG scores based on the stock and the index funds they have invested in. Bank of America, Citi, and other large banks have said that they are going to use their considerable wealth and power to accelerate the transition to a net zero global economy, in part by requiring their finance activities, operations, and supply chain go green. President Trump, special interest groups, and members of Congress have been banned from doing business with some banks and retailers now because of their political views. Politicians and pundits, some of which have millions of followers, have been banned or censored on social media platforms, a problem we will discuss at length in the next section. They lost this platform because they were just speaking out about the possibility of election fraud or for questioning the justification given by elites for stopping people from attending church services in the midst of a pandemic, while also encountering protesters who take to the streets by the tens of thousands to demand social justice. China has already developed and started to roll out a social credit system that includes a set of databases and initiatives that monitor and assess the trustworthiness of individuals, companies, and government entities. According to the South China Morning Post, each entry, meaning a human being, is given a social credit score with reward for those who have high ratings and punishments for those with low scores. 367. Businesses in China also are subjected to a credit scoring system. Business entities, including foreign businesses in China, are subject to a corporate credit system, tracking information such as tax payments, bank loan repayments, and employment disputes, the Morning Post also reported. And who are the key people in charge of running China's social credit system? Government bureaucrats and banks. According to the Morning Post, the databases are managed by China's economic planner, the National Development and Reform Commission, the People's Bank of China, and the country's court system. Any of this sound familiar to you? I mean, it's almost like Klaus Schwab took his ESG playbook directly from China, or that China took Schwab's ideas, which have been around for more than 50 years, and put them into action long before anyone in America had ever heard of environmental, social, and governance metrics. In our modern world, which is full of authoritarian power grabs and growing divide between ruling class and elites and everyone else, endless money printing, golden opportunity pandemics, a dishonest media, and the emergence of an authoritarian China as a global superpower, you would have to be certifiably insane if you weren't at least a little concerned about the possibility of every regular Joe and Jane in America receiving a score measuring how closely their investment decisions align with those of the ruling class. Big tech tyrants. Much of the Great Reset is focused on economic changes, but it would be a huge mistake to think that resetters are not interested in making expansive alterations to other parts of society as well. As the head of WEF, Klaus Schwab, wrote in 2020, quote, to achieve a better outcome, the world must act jointly and swiftly to revamp all aspects of our society and economies, from education to social contracts and working conditions, end quote. So what exactly does Schwab and other resetters have in mind when they make these far-reaching statements? At the very least, it includes left-wing ideas about enhancing social justice, as countless articles published on the World Economic Forum's website illustrates. In October 2020, David Sangacoya, the head of the WEF's Civil Society Communities and Social Justice Initiatives, authored an article titled Social Justice, Inclusion, and Sustainable Development Need a Great Reset. Here are the three steps we can take. In the article, Sangacoya summarizes the findings of the September 2020 WEF meeting of more than 3,800 leaders from government, business, and civil society called the Sustainable Development Impact Summit. According to Sangacoya, sessions held at the summit on social justice were of significant interest to business leaders navigating the ramifications of the pandemic and how to define their stakeholder responsibilities to social justice and sustainability. Sangacoya then describes the three key takeaways from the summit on, quote, driving a great reset in social justice, inclusion, and sustainable development impact, including this one, quote, widespread environmental crisis and global Black Lives Matter protests have sparked palpable restlessness for change. There is a need to accelerate both sustainability and social justice agendas from both employees and consumers, end quote. Of course, over the last few years, we've learned that one of the ways corporations can accelerate social justice agendas is to stifle the free speech of anyone who stands in the way of the Great Reset or any other cause embraced by the elites. That's why the Great Reset agenda includes the WEF's Global Alliance for Responsible Media. Man, they never seem to run out of new Orwellian names for their little authoritarian clubs, do they? The purpose of the Global Alliance for Responsible Media is to partner corporations and advertisers with publishers and platforms to do more to address harmful and misleading media environments and to develop and deliver against a concrete set of actions, processes, and protocols for protecting brands. In between the time of this writing and this recording, Sports Illustrated just announced their new swimsuit issue, and you can only advertise in it if your company has made a commitment to the progress of women. According to WEF, among the perceived problems publishers and platforms need to do more to address are bullying, hate speech, and disinformation, all of which are words regularly used by elites to unfairly smear, well, just about anyone who doesn't agree with their own vision for the world. By the way, another reason why you should order this book in paperback or in hardcover now. Some European countries have already started requiring social media companies to restrict free speech. In May 2020, CNN reported, the French parliament passed a controversial hate speech law that would fine social media companies if they fail to remove certain illegal content within 24 hours, and in some cases, as little as 1 hour. CNN further reported the new regulation calls for the tech platforms to remove hateful comments based on race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, or disability, as well as sexual harassment, within 24 hours after they are flagged by users. Companies that fail to comply with the 24-hour rule would be fined as much as $1.36 million per violation. But there would be no fines if platforms permanently remove content that is later deemed acceptable. Oh, end quote. The law was based on similar legislation already in place in Germany, the Network Enforcement Act, which mandates that social media companies remove hate speech and fake news within 24 hours of it being flagged, or face penalties of up to roughly $60 million, according to CNN. They also must publish reports every 6 months detailing the number of complaints of illegal content they have received. Courts struck down much of the French law in June 2020 for violating the country's constitution, but that hasn't stopped some affiliated with the World Economic Forum from continuing to promote similar mandates. WEF continues to display on its website a March 2018 article titled, How Technology Can Be Used to Combat Online Hate Speech, authored by La Trobe University lecturer André Obler. In the article, Obler suggests that government should follow the lead of Germany in imposing financial penalties on major social media companies if they fail to reduce the volume of abusive content on their platforms, end quote. Obler further said, we must develop ways of correctly identifying and measuring the amount of abusive content being posted and removed to ensure that companies are complying. Although it's unlikely such a law would survive a challenge in the U.S. Supreme Court, it is vital to remember that a model like the one proposed by supporters of the Great Reset would work around the free speech protections guaranteed by our First Amendment because it would not mandate that companies do anything to stop free speech. It would just heavily coerce them into eliminating speech until they effectively have no choice but to act in line with the demands of the ruling class. It's not hard to imagine how Great Reset ideas about limiting speech, especially when coupled with the other Great Reset initiatives previously discussed, could result in unprecedented and dangerous assaults on speech here in the United States. This is especially true for conservatives and other free speech advocates who are already experiencing the early stages of the left's digital purge of free thinkers, conservative voices, and even some political figures. In the wake of the riots at the U.S. Capitol building in January, which occurred following a rally promoted by President Trump, a long list of social media companies banned Trump from using their service, including Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter. But social media platforms didn't stop at President Trump himself. An unprecedented wave of social media bans soon followed that spread well beyond Trump. As the Federalist Joy Pullman noted in a January 2021 column, the purge wasn't at all limited to Trump himself. It's also pursuing his supporters. YouTube banned all videos discussing voter fraud. Reddit shut down its Donald Trump subreddit. On January 8th, Facebook shut down the Walkaway campaign that shared the stories of people who left the Democratic Party to vote for Trump and banned every one of the group's owners from using Facebook. 381. Facebook also permanently banned clothing retailer Patriotic Me from advertising any of its products on its platform, apparently for violating some unknown Facebook community standard. To give you the sense of some of the dangerous products offered by Patriotic Me, read the following description of the site by one reporter covering the ban. Quote, the apparel sold by Patriotic Me has, well, an obvious patriotic flair. These are shirts adorned with red, white, blue, or an outline of the United States. Hoodies with the American flag. Hats you could proudly wear to your 4th of July cookout. And every other day, too. Just because you love America. 382. According to the same reporter, a portion of every single sale made on Patriotic Me is donated to the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, a charity founded to honor the sacrifice of New York City firefighter Stephen Siller, who gave his life to save others as a first responder on September 11, 2001. Tunnel to Towers provides mortgage-free smart homes to veterans or first responders with catastrophic injuries suffered in the line of duty, or to Gold Star families with surviving spouses and young children, end quote. Oh my gosh, let me take a minute. What monsters, right? I am sure glad Facebook is cracking down on the sale of all those violence-inducing hoodies with the outline of America. Woo! Can you imagine all of that dirty money then going to help veterans and first responders gain access to mortgage-free homes? Huh. Then there was AR15.com. The biggest gun forum in the world, AR15.com, committed the unspeakable crime of letting law-abiding Americans talk online about firearms and gun ownership, a constitutionally protected, God-given right, by the way. Hosting company GoDaddy suddenly just terminated access to the website in January 21 for allegedly violating GoDaddy's terms of service without providing any detailed explanation for the decision or the ability to appeal. But as bad as these attacks on speech were, they pale in comparison to the shocking treatment of Parler, an online social media platform similar to Twitter. In 2018, after years of social media companies deplatforming, mistreating, and unfairly targeting conservatives, including many of the people who work for me at my media company, Blaze Media, John Madz and Jared Thompson launched a new platform. They called it Parler. Unlike establishment social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, Parler promised to protect users' privacy and promote free speech by allowing voices from all walks of life to share their political, religious, or ideological views without fear of being punished by big tech or its flawed algorithms. Rather than rely on unaccountable speech police at companies like Google and Facebook, Parler empowered users with a wealth of tools to customize their experience on the platform. Contrary to what you will read in dishonest so-called mainstream media outlets, Parler was not a conservative social media platform. Anyone can join. Many people who did join were not conservative. Parler's rise to prominence was nothing short of amazing. After initially numbering only thousands of users, Parler's user list skyrocketed into the millions in just 2 years of its launch. In July 2020, Parler reported 2.8 million users, and by early November 2020, the app reported 8 million users. In the week following the 2020 election alone, Parler gained more than 3.5 million users, putting it at the top of Apple's App Store list of free apps. Now, by the end of November, the number of users on Parler hit 10 million. And at the conclusion of 2020, the app's user base was on track to hit 20 million in 2021. Countless media outlets, politicians, radio hosts had joined in 2020, myself included. On Apple's iOS App Store, the application used by every single iPhone user in the world to download new applications for their phone, Parler had recorded a whopping 8.1 million new installs in 2020, making it the 10th most downloaded social media application in the store over the course of a year. Parler was well on its way to becoming a real competitor to the establishment social media giants at the start of 2021, with some analysts anticipating the value of the company could soon be $1 billion or more. But all of that soon changed. The New York Times recorded the incredible chain of events in January 13 news report. See, I told you I read the New York Times, which noted, by Saturday morning, Apple listed Parler as the number one free app for its iPhones. But by Saturday night, Parler was suddenly fighting for its life. The Times further reported, quote, first Apple and Google removed the app from their app stores because they said it had not sufficiently policed its users' posts, allowing too many that encouraged violence and crime. Then, late Saturday, Amazon told Parler that it would boot the company from its web hosting service on Sunday night because of repeated violations of Amazon's rules. Amazon's move meant that Parler's entire platform would soon go offline unless it was able to find a new hosting service on Sunday. The Sunday deadline came and went as expected. Amazon shut Parler down. Parler initially anticipated it could quickly shift its operations to an Amazon competitor. But one web hosting service after another refused Parler's business. And it was not long before other third-party vendors and businesses also banned Parler from using their services. Within just 1 week of the moves by Apple, Google, and Amazon, three of the wealthiest, most powerful companies on the planet, all of which are run by people hostile to conservative ideas, Parler's CEO announced that one of the only services the platform still had up and running was its company's email account. Now, the justification used by big tech to attack the country's most popular social media outlet guaranteeing free speech is that Parler had not done enough to remove posts considered dangerous by Amazon, Apple, and Google. The legacy media was quick to come to the aid of these tech tyrants, insisting, often without providing any evidence, that Parler had become a bastion of hate and extremism. Well, contrary to the unfair characterizations of Parler appearing in many biased media outlets, Parler did not and does not now allow users to post literally anything they want. Parler's terms of service prohibits all sorts of material considered harmful to the platform's community. In a July 2020 article for the left-leaning online publication, The Conversation, academic Audrey Cortry reviewed Parler's terms of service and community standards and found a closer look at its user agreement suggests it moderates content the same way as any platform, and maybe even more, end quote. Courtney also noted, Parler's community guidelines prohibit a range of content, including spam, terrorism, unsolicited ads, defamation, blackmail, bribery, and criminal behavior. Although there are no explicit rules against hate speech, there are policies against fighting words and threats of harm. This includes a threat of or advocating for violation against an individual or group. There are rules against content that is obscene, sexual, or, quote, lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, end quote. For example, just visuals of genitalia, female nipples, or fecal matter are barred from Parler. Cordy's analysis is generally in line with other reports by media about Parler that were published throughout 2020. Numerous media outlets went out of their way to talk about how, even though Parler's marketing campaign presented the platform as a free speech haven, Parler also frequently moderated content considered extremely offensive or violent. Some critics of Parler even suggested the platform was hypocritical for doing so. Newsweek published an article titled, Parler, the Ted Cruz-approved free speech app, is already banning users. Fortune.com posted an article in July 2020 called Conservative Social Media Darling Parler Discovers That Free Speech is Messy, end quote. Washington Post published a piece called The Conservative Alternative to Twitter Wants to Be a Place for Free Speech for All, but it turns out rules still apply. It was not until Parler's popularity soared to even greater heights that the platform suddenly became, in the eyes of the media, an ultra-violent website that must be closed down because, according to the press, only radical extremists use it. In addition to being misleading and or factually incorrect, many of the criticisms leveled against Parler in 2021 were wildly hypocritical. It is true that there were, and probably still are, some vile, disgusting, and violent posts on Parler. And I do believe Parler should do all it can to remove such content and to do it more quickly. Parler officials themselves admitted that they had a backlog of thousands of complaints at the time Amazon took down the site. However, it is also true that Facebook, Twitter, and Google regularly hosted equally vile, disgusting, and violent rhetoric. No one knows this better than I do. Well, Donald Trump, and then maybe me. My family and I have been subject to tens of thousands of threats, personal attacks, foul insults over the years through my social media platforms. And that's just counting the mean stuff my producer has written about me. I have not seen a shred of evidence to suggest that Facebook and Twitter have permanently banned all the users who posted this material about me, my staff, or my family, much of which I'm sure violates their community standards. And I know for a fact that Stu is still allowed to post his nonsensical rantings all over the internet. Facebook, Google, and Twitter have also routinely been used by violent groups to stage riots and events meant to cause destruction and impose fear, including groups associated with the January 2021 Capitol Hill riot. Further, there is no denying that social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have in some cases gone out of their way to protect accounts controlled by truly dangerous political or social leaders. Take, for example, the Twitter account of the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. This is the supreme dictator, the supreme leader of Iran, a country that has for decades violated human rights, supported terrorism, destabilized the Middle East, even waged a stealth war against the United States, had just put out a hit on Donald Trump. While accounts and tweets from conservatives are being banned by Twitter's thought police in 2020 and 2021, Khamenei's account and its many violent tweets, they're fine. They remain intact, including one from 2018 that reads, "Our stance against Israel is the same stance we have always taken. Hashtag Israel is a malignant cancerous tumor in the West Asian region that has to be removed and eradicated. It is possible and it will happen," end quote. I mean, are there any Twitter, any standards there that maybe Khamenei violated with that one? Or perhaps calling for the genocide of a historically abused religious and ethnic group doesn't mean as much to Twitter. I suppose it's true Khamenei could be worse in the eyes of social media speech police. At least he didn't vote for Donald Trump, right? Further, Twitter continues to allow radicals like Louis Farrakhan and Chinese propagandists to regularly spew false information to their huge social media followings. And Twitter and other social media giants have also refused to warn readers when pundits spread demonstrably false information and conspiracy theories about Russian collusion, including claims that were wildly debunked years ago. They have also chosen not to silence politicians who have openly called for people to harass government officials in the Trump administration and conservative public figures, nor have they banned users who openly sympathized with the rioters who burned and looted cities throughout the summer of 2020. In 2018, Congresswoman Maxine Waters told her supporters, "If you see anyone from that cabinet in that Trump administration, in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd and you push back on them and you tell them you're not welcome anymore anywhere." Well, I am a doctor and a writer, so I should listen to my opinion on this, but that sure sounds like Representative Waters is inciting criminal activity, doesn't it? Yet Twitter continues to allow Maxine to engage with her 1.6 million followers on its platform every day. CNN host Chris Cuomo, the brother of Andrew Cuomo, everyone's least favorite Sopranos character and one of the worst governors in American history, said in the midst of a period of widespread rioting and looting in the summer of 2020, quote, "And please show me where it says protesters are supposed to be polite and peaceful, because I can show you that outraged citizens are what made the country and what she is and led to any major milestone. To be honest, this isn't a tranquil time, end quote. That's weird that he said that, and yet Chris Cuomo is still able to communicate with his 2.1 million Twitter followers every single day. In waging its war on Parler, big tech could not have been clearer. If you are a free speech-friendly platform that tries to limit violent speech, but struggles, like all social media companies, to root out every single vile post, you deserve to be destroyed. But if you're a media outlet or platform that allows or promotes dangerous, reckless, or misleading information, but generally still favors and promotes causes that the ruling class elites and their allies, those things that they like, well, then you deserve special legal protection that allows big tech investors to earn billions of dollars and amass unprecedented amounts of power. Welcome to the start of the Great Reset, ladies and gentlemen. Some Americans on the left, even some libertarians on the right, argue that Americans should not be concerned about digital crackdowns on speech. We are frequently told private companies can do whatever they want to control speech on their platforms. It's a free market. But the truth is, there is nothing free about big tech's actions, and there won't be anything free market about a Great Reset ESG system that awards woke companies for stifling speech. Companies will merely be acting to stay on the good side of government and big financial institutions, as many do now, because that is where the money will be in a world dominated by ESG scores and modern monetary theorists like Stephanie Kelton. When confronted with arguments alleging that anyone who stands against big tech tyrants is working against the free market capitalism, it is important to remember that corporations, whether they be massive online retailers or social media giants like Facebook, are themselves the products of government. Not only are corporations subject to countless regulations governing their behavior, but they are also made possible only by special laws that do not exist in a marketplace free of government interference. Big corporations do not pay the same tax rates as individuals. Don't operate under many of the same rules as individuals or face the same legal liabilities as individuals. And that is especially true of numerous large technology companies, which in countless cases are able to exist only because federal law allows them to avoid the lawsuits when users post illegal or defamatory content on their platforms. There used to be a time when even many elites understood that corporations should not have unlimited power. Consider the following quote from the opinion issued in 1946 by the Supreme Court in Marsh versus Alabama, a case in which the court determined that a private corporation could not prohibit a Jehovah Witness from distributing religious materials in a company-owned town because the ban was in violation of the First Amendment. Quote, ownership does not always mean absolute dominion, wrote Hugo Black, a justice appointed, by the way, by one of the 20th century's most progressive presidents, Franklin Roosevelt. Quote, the more an owner, for his own advantage, opens up his property for use by the public in general, the more do his rights become circumscribed by the statutory and constitutional rights of those who use it. Thus, the owners of privately held bridges, ferries, turnpikes, and railroads may not operate them as freely as a farmer does on his farm. Make no mistake about it. Large corporations ought to be given a great deal of authority over their products, services, and property. But it should never be forgotten that corporations are not divine institutions fully endowed with inalienable rights, but rather creations of government that exist to offer to the public, everyone in the public, goods and services. There is no reason why they should have the power to silence political or religious speech. Americans who are demanding that corporations be required to promote individual rights as a condition of having access to special legal protections ought not to feel even slightly ashamed for doing so. It can't happen here. Wait, can it? When I talk to others about the Great Reset, I am often met at first with a healthy dose of skepticism. And I do mean it. It is good. It's healthy to question. Not only is all of that stakeholder capitalist language misleading and confusing, but many people also have difficulty accepting that something like the reset really could happen in America. I mean, this is, after all, the home of the largest, most powerful financial markets on the planet, the world's most profitable companies, and the biggest and best economic engine humankind has ever seen. Yeah, Glenn, we get it. Those Europeans love big government systems and elitism, and they've cozied up to fascism before. But America's not Europe. What are you so worried about? Well, in addition to snakes and those really huge spiders in Australia, because those things freak me out, I am worried that many of the leaders of the biggest institutions in the world, from the United Nations and the International Monetary Fund to multi-billion-dollar corporations on Wall Street, have started adopting many of the Great Reset's principles and promoting its expansion, and that many of the people involved are American and have already started to promote the reset in the United States. In fact, according to a report by KPMG, thousands of companies located in more than 50 countries have ESG systems in place, including 82% of large companies in the United States. It's a conspiracy? 82% already have it. Further, American financial institutions have already built massive ESG databases to track and even predict companies' ESG scores. Moody's database has more than 140 million company ESG scores, covering 220 countries. And now it sells a tool to help banks, corporations, and other institutions predict the ESG scores of small and medium-sized companies around the world. Gee, I wonder if I have a good score. Including countless companies that have never once submitted ESG data or reports. So that means if you don't turn an ESGN report into Moody's, it just might invent one for you, whether you like it or not, or whether it's accurate or not. Most important, although it has not received nearly enough media attention, shocking, I know many politicians, activists, and bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. They support the Great Reset policies and are deeply committed to making them a reality, even if they do not typically use the Great Reset slogan on the campaign trail or in the halls of Congress. But first among them, President Joe Biden. The Biden administration and his allies are not merely calling for Great Reset policies. They've already started to put in place the policy and regulatory framework necessary to make the Great Reset a reality. And they have done so at a speed at the end of the Trump administration almost no one thought was possible. So how exactly are the Biden administration and other elites planning on altering American society in line with the Great Reset principles? That is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 6, Joe Biden and the Great Reset of America. Why should Russians have all the fun of remaking a world? Stuart Chase, an advisor to President Franklin Roosevelt, in his book, A New Deal, 1932. The first 50 years of the 20th century were filled with nearly unimaginable horror and despair. 20 million people died in World War I, which was the war to end all wars, we were told by the experts, and another 21 million were wounded. As many as 100 million people perished during the 1918-1919 influenza outbreak. 75 million people were killed during World War II, including millions of European Jews who were murdered during the Nazis' Holocaust. During the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, 15 million Americans were unemployed, and the United States faced unprecedented chaos in its financial industry. Nearly half of all U.S. banks failed. Segregation gripped the southern United States, severely limiting the opportunities and rights of African Americans. The Titanic, the world's first unsinkable ship, sank. However, despite these grave tragedies, the United States endured and in many respects significantly progressed. offering periods of immense positive economic and societal changes. The horse-driven carriage was replaced with the motor vehicle. Widespread access to electricity transformed America's economy and dramatically improved living standards. The Wright brothers showed the world that humans could take flight. More than 15 million people immigrated to America's shores from 1900 to 1915, helping push the U.S. economy far beyond its global competitors and greatly expanding the country's urban centers. For better or for worse, the period from 1900 to the end of World War II is best defined by one word: disruption. And it always has been the case in human history, whenever there is a disruption, there is a great opportunity for radical change, or as they are fond of saying in America's favorite television documentary series, Game of Thrones, chaos is a ladder. The rise of progressivism in the United States in the early 20th century would not have been possible without the era's tremendous disruption. Progressives knew this, and they took advantage. In the early days of the progressive movement, leaders developed a playbook for remaking society by shifting power into the hands of elites who would use centralized bureaucratic agencies, international organizations, and large businesses and financial institutions to enact their far-reaching reforms. Although progressive elites' plan has gone through a variety of phases, it has remained mostly unchanged over the past 100 years. The faces and some of the methods have evolved, to be sure, but the foundational goals and strategies are nearly identical to those established at the start of the progressive era. One of the clearest articulations for progressives' plan for a new society was revealed in the 1940s by Stuart Chase, perhaps the most influential American economist of his time and a member of Franklin Roosevelt's famous Brain Trust. Chase is most famous in progressive and socialist circles today for developing the New Deal political slogan later adopted by FDR. In the early 1940s, the 20th Century Fund, an influential organization devoted to promoting progressive causes, commissioned Chase to write a series of small books called When the War Ends, 406. The purpose of the book series was to advocate for the advancement of a new society following the conclusion of World War II. In the very first book of the series, titled The Road Which We Are Traveling, published in 1942, Chase claims there is no hope of returning to a system of free enterprise at the conclusion of the war. Why? Because according to Chase, the basic conditions which made it a good and workable system for a century or more have changed, so it has now become unworkable over great areas. In its place, Chase believed the global economy had already started the process of transforming into something entirely new, a managerial revolution that is displacing the system of free enterprise all over the world. Because this revolution had not been named, Chase simply called it X. Now, his vision for a novel economic model was not merely part of a proposed alteration of society. It was viewed by Chase and others as essential and inevitable. In Chase's mind, the world was moving towards System X, whether Americans liked it or not. And although he acknowledged that some folks might be worried by such a change, Chase, like most elitist progressives of the period, believed everyone would be better off under a managerial state. Win, lose, or draw, Chase wrote, we can never return to the world of 1928 or even 1939. This may alarm many Americans, but it does not alarm me. The old world was not so perfect that a better one cannot be found. In The Road in Which We Are Traveling, Chase outlines the framework of that better world, much of which had already become the guiding principles of the Roosevelt administration prior to the start of World War II. In a subsection of his book titled Free Enterprise into X, Chase listed 18 characteristics of X: a strong, centralized government, an executive arm growing at the expense of the legislative and judicial arms. In some countries, power is consolidated into a dictator issuing decrees. The control of banking, credit, and security exchanges by the government. the underwriting of employment by the government, either through armaments or public works, the underwriting of Social Security by the government, old age pensions, mother's pensions, unemployment insurance, and the like, the underwriting of food, housing, and medical care by the government. The United States, he writes, already experimenting with providing these essentials. Other nations are far along the road. The use of deficit spending technique to finance these underwritings. The annually balanced budget has just lost its old-time sanctity. The abandonment of gold in favor of managed currencies. The control of foreign trade by the government with increasing emphasis on bilateral agreements and barter deals. The control of natural resources with increasing emphasis on self-sufficiency. The control of energy sources, hydroelectric power, coal, petroleum, natural gas. The control of transportation, railway, highway, airway, waterway. The control of agricultural production. The control of labor organizations, often to the point of prohibiting strikes. The enlistment of young men and women into a youth corps devoted to health, discipline, community service, and ideologies consistent with those of the authorities. The CCC camps have just inaugurated military drill. Heavy taxation, he continues, with special emphasis on the estates and incomes of the rich. Not much taking over of property or industries in the old socialistic sense. The formula appears to be control without ownership. It's interesting to recall that the same formula was used by the management of great corporations in depriving stockholders of power. The state control of communications and propaganda. So Chase is very clear that not every single part of X ought to be pursued in the same manner in which it had been imposed outside of the United States. For example, it appears Chase was not an advocate of dictatorships, despite having acknowledged some forms of System X include totalitarian rule. However, for Chase, System X was the future. Quote, "It is a question not of kind, but of degree," he wrote. Throughout the 1930s and 1940s, American progressive elites set out to implement their own version of System X, and to a large extent, they were successful. By the end of the Franklin Roosevelt administration, more federal social programs had been created than at any other time in U.S. history. Instead of relying primarily on a belief in the power of the free markets and individual choice, millions of Americans became dependent on the federal government's Civilian Conservation Corps, Farm Security Administration, the Resettlement Administration, or the National Youth Administration, and countless other alphabet soup government bureaucracies. Progressives also used the era's disruption to transform government and financial institutions. State legislatures lost their ability to elect U.S. senators. The size of the House of Representatives was permanently capped at 435, all but ensuring the creation and maintenance of a legislative oligarchy in Washington, D.C. Federal bureaucracies seized more and more power from state and local governments. The Federal Reserve System was created. Federal officials began the process of ending the gold standard, paving the way for massive future government debt. Progressives' vision for establishing a vast federal bureaucracy of experts to manage society was well on its way to becoming fully realized from 1900 to 1940, and then again during the President Lyndon Johnson Great Society reforms in the 1960s. Fortunately, pushback from political opponents, several key losses in the Supreme Court, and the conclusion of World War II, and most importantly, the rise of totalitarian communism in China and Russia, it thwarted the progressives' plan to impose X, not entirely, but enough to stop them from reaching their ultimate goal. Fascism, authoritarianism, communism had all been discredited by the death camps. But by the end of the Reagan administration in 1989, communism had been defeated, and the political and social winds had shifted back in favor of a conservative and limited government. Ronald Reagan's brilliant public relations strategy for defeating the Soviets, which focused on the fundamental differences between free capitalist societies and the brutal socialistic models used by regimes in places like the Soviet Union and Cuba, inspired a new generation to recognize and appreciate America's exceptional past and foundational goals. For the most part, conservative values dominated the post-Soviet era. That is, until President Barack Obama rose to power, which, as at the start of the progressive era, was largely the result of an ineffective Republican president and a government-created crisis, the financial system collapse in 2008. Just like the end of FDR's reign, the final year of the Obama era was full of optimism for progressives. After decades of failing to recapture the momentum enjoyed during the days of FDR's New Deal and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, President Obama managed to get the country moving back toward the vision of reshaping American society imagined by President Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and influential intellectuals of the progressive era like Stuart Chase. In 2016, Hillary Clinton was well positioned to finish what Obama started, but then something happened, something remarkable, and I mean remarkable in nearly every sense of the word. Donald Trump, a reality television star and real estate mogul, was elected president of the United States, a feat he managed to accomplish by running on an American First platform that denounced most of the essential parts of System X. And whether you love him or loathe him, if you are fair-minded, you have to admit that there's a good chance that had the COVID-19 pandemic never occurred, Donald Trump would still be president today. As I discussed at length in Chapter 2, it was COVID-19 that provided global elites with another golden opportunity to reset the global economy and finish the job started by European and American elites in the progressive era. Today's great